Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Military History Inside Out. Today I speak with John Reeves, who's written The Lost Indictment of Robert E. Lee. It's about an indictment or a series of indictments against Robert E. Lee and 30-some Confederate officers right after the war, where the North wanted them obviously jailed for treason against the United States. So we discuss the indictments, the steps that Robert E. Lee took to defend himself, how he dealt with that whole issue, what kind of case the federal government was bringing against Robert E. Lee. We talk about other aspects of the Civil War and then the time after the Civil War, the few years that Robert E. Lee lived between 65 and 70. So definitely an interesting interview about post-war issues, and especially the U.S. Civil War. Thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with John Reeves, author of The Lost Indictment of Robert E. Lee. Thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
So tell me how you got into professional writing and history.
Yeah, so, you know, I was a history teacher for about 15 years, and I taught American and European history in New York City and London. And so, you know, I obviously have been studying history for a long time. I then I had a short stint where I was writing about finance as well, and was a writer and editor in finance. So you know, that was my background, and then this topic caught my eye, and I really thought I had book idea with it, and then went forward with it from there.
Okay. You kind of answered this already, but have you always wanted to write about a book on this particular subject?
Yeah. You know, I think that I've always enjoyed writing, and I think I've sort of, you know, I earlier had an academic background, but then I also kind of have been interested in sort of investigating and, you know, unearthing certain things. You know what I mean? So I combined those two interests to write this book. But yeah, I've always enjoyed writing, and I've wanted to write a book for, you know, my whole professional career.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the subject matter of this book.
Yeah, so, you know, I'll start with a short version of it, and then we can expand from there. But, you know, I got interested in Robert E. Lee as a person who attempted to bring North and South together at the end of the war. So, you know, I had read that, you know, hey, he was a real agent of healing after the war. And then as I pursued that topic, I found, you know, yes, that's true. But there was also this other element that I hadn't heard anyone write about before, and that was that Northerners wanted to punish him for treason, and they brought charges against him, and President Andrew Johnson and his cabinet were in earnest of wanting to prosecute him and punish him, along with the other Confederate leaders. And I think I found, hey, here's a story that I haven't heard before, or, you know, or if it had been covered, it was, you know, in passing, you know. So as I dug further, I found more and more. And that's where the Lost Indictment title comes from, because the indictment of the actual physical document did go missing, but so did the story about this attempt to prosecute him. I think has really disappeared from our consciousness as a nation, and this book is sort of an attempt to revisit those days shortly after the Civil War.
So, how much of the book is about him as a person versus the actual indictment, or, you know, how does it break down?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I would look at it this way. The book really focuses on the last 5 years of his life. So, you know, obviously he surrenders in Appomattox in 1865, and he died in 1870. So, the thread of those last years is, you know, this case against him, and then his attempt to defend himself. And through that thread, I covered those last 5 years of his life, and I do talk a lot about his character and his, you know, different events in his private life. But one of the elements that I talk about in the book is there was this legal case against him, right? The actual treason charge, and his concern that he might be facing prosecution, and then he also, you know, he applied for amnesty, and he filled out the oath that was required as part of the application for amnesty. And, you know, and he corresponded with friends and colleagues, and he actually immersed himself in a little bit in the constitutional questions to kind of almost defend himself that, hey, you know, this was not settled constitutional law, so what I did was very justifiable in his opinion. So there was this legal case that he was facing. But there was also, and I spend a lot of time in the book about this too, there was also what I call a moral case against him. So one of the things that was happening in the press is that he was attacked as a hypocrite, for example, on the issue of slavery, that Lee liked to present himself as an opponent of slavery, and that a lot of Northerners in the press were saying, you know, actually, you're a slave owner, and you had 200 some odd slaves that you were managing after your father's mom passed away, and that some even accused him of brutality as a slave owner, actually beating, you know, whipping the slaves, having the slaves whipped, and so there was this attack on him as a slave owner and being a hypocrite on that topic, because he liked to present himself as someone who's a hypocrite. And then another thing that he was attacked on was the issue of the treatment of prisoners of war. And that was one thing I found was a very big topic in the 1860s that maybe we don't remember as much today. You know, when you talk about the Civil War today, you don't hear a lot of people getting very upset about the treatment of prisoners at Andersonville Prison, for example. At least I don't. You know, that's not a topic often raised when things were still in the discussion. But it was a big issue back then, and Lee was very defensive about that. And what I found in my book, what I talk about, is that on the one hand, I think Lee had a legitimate case that he was being unfairly treated on the issue. I mean, I think Lee wasn't primarily responsible for the way Union prisoners were treated at the various prisons throughout the South. And, you know, I think that's pushing the criticism, I think, of him a little too far, because he had more than enough on his plate, wasn't involved in the day-to-day. But what I did discover is that he also upheld the policy that we would think of as sort of odious today, and that was the Confederacy treated African-American soldiers unfairly. It didn't give them the same protections that their Northern brethren received. And the key issue, I think the key distinction was that the Confederates would argue, well, they used to be our property, so why should we be treating them as prisoners of war under the laws of war? But the real, I think, problem with that is many of the African American Union soldiers were freedmen, that they were freed before they joined the service, and they weren't receiving the same, you know, treatment. And in that respect, that seems to me like a violation of the laws of war as they were understood at that time. You know, so anyway, I do talk about those. And so those are all issues that, you know, Lee was thinking about and writing about in his correspondence. You know, a lot of his correspondence he insisted not be published at the time, because he liked to avoid the appearance of saying politics. But so these were all preoccupations of his, and I think were part of those final 5 years of his life that, you know, I talk about in the book.
So what, was it a federal court that brought charges against him? And I guess it was Norfolk, Virginia?
Yes. So it was a federal court. And the judge is a very interesting character who I talked a lot about. You know, he's not someone, I don't think is not someone who's widely known. But the judge who brought, who presided over the indictment, obviously it was the district attorney who brought the charges with the grand jury, but the judge who presided was very active, and, you know, for our time, he was very political. he really was an abolitionist and had a strong opinion that even though he was a Virginian, he had lived in the North and was a Unionist, even mm. though he lived in the South. So, you know, a Southerner who supported the Union. So he was maybe an unusual character in that respect. But his name was Judge John C. Unruly. Mm. And so he was the one who brought the indictment in the federal court. And one of the things that I talked about in the book is that if they were to go forward with the trials, that if they made a decision early on that it would be obviously a federal circuit court would be the jurisdiction for the trials, and that they wanted the Chief Justice, Salmon Chase, to be one of the judges that presided in addition to Underwood. So it would have been Underwood and Chase, and there had that tradition of the Chief Justice appearing in a treason trial. You might remember Aaron Burr. You know, he famously charged with treason, and Chief Justice Marshall presided over that case. And so for the same, they wanted Chase in this one. And one of the, you know, and there's so many people to tell that you have to clarify. It was also quite common for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to also appear as just a normal judge in a circuit court at that time. So, in addition to presiding over, you know, the bigger questions with his fellow justices of the Supreme Court, he also had to do, you know, a normal caseload. They would call it riding circuit. You know, he would go sit in the various circuit courts. And his circuit, I think, included Virginia, Maryland, and one other state, so it was North Carolina. So it was smaller, but So it was an interesting element to it that they would insist on the two judges being presiding over these trials.
So I assume he was free during the course of the trial. He wasn't jailed.
Yeah, so you know what's funny is that in and of itself is an interesting question, and that I also cover in the book. And I think that this one might be something that might appeal to readers because Ulysses S. Grant has been in the news a lot with the Chernow book. And the reason why Lee and his fellow Confederate leaders weren't jailed after the indictment, because Johnson was prepared to do so, was that Grant stepped in at that point and said, look, you know, you need to honor that agreement I made with Lee at Appomattox. You cannot jail these men. And then Johnson was, and then they had an argument about that. And where it came out was that they couldn't prosecute Lee and the other 36 who were indicted by Underwood until the war was officially over. Because as long as the war was going on, they were paroled prisoners who were protected by that agreement they made in Appomattox. But, you know, a lot of people might not know this. The war didn't end in 1865. It eventually ended in August 1866 when the last of the rebellion in Texas was put down. And then they kind of officially made it end. So, from a legal and an official point, of course, it was for all intents and purposes over after Johnston surrendered to Sherman in North Carolina. But anyway, this is an important point because I think if anyone is even vaguely familiar with this topic, they will often say, well, Grant quashed the indictment, meaning that Grant stepped in with Johnson in June of 1865 and said, I'm just not going to put up with this. And then it was over and that was that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Grant himself was someone in his older years put that story forward. You know what I mean? It's kind of dramatic. And, you know, Grant looked Johnson in the eye and said, I'm not going to have this. Mm-hmm. And then that wasn't really what happened. And Johnson was quite stubborn and quite powerful figure himself. And basically he heard Grant out and then he felt, well, the one point I will concede is that I can't, that as long as the war is still officially going on, they're protected. But once the war is over, I'm going to move on these guys. And then what they decided to do in the interim is to try Jefferson Davis, who was not protected by any military parole, and that he would be also probably maybe a more sinister character to go after. Davis was less popular than me. So, you know, the way I frame it in my book is, I think they were thinking, hey, look, if we can't win against Jefferson Davis, we probably couldn't convict the others. So let's start with him.
Right.
Yeah.
So you said there were 36 others along with Lee?
Yeah, in the Underwood Court, there were 37 who were indicted in June of 1865. And then later, in the Underwood Court, Jefferson Davis was indicted as well. Also, there would be 39 indicted by Underwood himself.
Were they all resident? I'm sorry?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 39 indicted by the Underwood Court.
So were they all residents of Virginia, or was there some reason that, if they weren't, was there some reason Virginia was the nexus?
No, that's an excellent point, because they weren't all Virginians, but they were all accused of making war in Virginia. And there was a little bit of a debate over where they should be tried. And it was ultimately decided that the Attorney General, James Speed, was insistent on this, that they needed to be tried where the treason was committed. And it was determined that the treason was committed in Virginia. And so, as you might imagine, that was a critical decision to make in a negative sense for the government, because a jury trial in Virginia was going to be extremely difficult to get the conviction. Do you know what I mean? Because, the average jury pool in Virginia, at least half or probably more, were probably sympathetic to the Confederacy. Certainly were sympathetic to Robert E. Lee. Maybe a little less than with Jefferson Davis, but still. So, by deciding to try this thing in Virginia, they really made their life difficult. But it was thought that was necessary. There were some critics who were saying, hey, why not try these people in the northern state or in Washington, D.C.? And that's where the kind of case law is interesting. They kind of went back to Chief Justice Marshall, who ruled that, the American Constitution defines treason. It's the only crime that is actually defined in the Constitution. And that their understanding of it was that it really needed to be war being made, and it needed to be prosecuted where that happened. And you couldn't just randomly try it in Massachusetts, because it would be easier to get a conviction there. They just didn't think that was the right way to go. So, in fairness to the Johnson administration, they took their responsibility quite seriously, and they tried to go forward with the Constitution as their guide as best as they could. So, but that was one key decision that they made.
So, how much information were you able to get on how Lee was planning to defend himself, and also the other defendants, and was there any collaboration on defending together or in the same way?
Yeah, so, it's sort of interesting because they all did different things. So, for example, one of these, a couple of them left the country. So one of Lee's lieutenants, who was a general, Jubal Early, fled to Canada. And so he just escaped it all together. And then, so I talk a lot about Lee. And so, Lee defended himself on the merits. So as I told you, he learned about constitutional law, and he really was insistent that he had done nothing wrong, and he kind of really laid out his case that, hey, there was a lot of disagreement about whether or not a state could leave the Union, Virginia in his case, and that, this was unsettled to him. I think I told you about that. So he did put a lot of effort into that. All that having been said, he also had a real kind of fatalistic attitude to it. And I actually read about this a little bit in the book, that he made many statements along the lines of, look, here I am, if they want to come get me and arrest me and find me, you know, go for it. Because, you know, I'm an old man. It's funny, he really wasn't by our standards. He had suffered a heart attack right before the Battle of Gettysburg, and his health was quite poor, and he aged much more quickly than he should have did. So in any event, he felt old and tired from maybe the years of war and whatever, but he was sort of very fatalistic and resigned to whatever would happen. I don't know if you know this, but I write about it in the book, and that is, he was called up to Washington, D.C., and had to appear before a congressional committee, and they questioned him for about 2 hours. And I write that was almost like a dry run for what a trial may have been like. You know, he was asked about treason and asked about his attitude towards the war, and he was asked all these questions. And so I write about that. It's a really kind of an interesting episode in American history that, you know, Lee took the train from Lexington, Virginia, and came up to D.C. He stayed in a hotel in D.C. He could see Arlington, but he didn't go there. His estate in Arlington, he just felt it was too painful to see his family home, his family estate. So anyway, it's a very interesting episode, but you know, there you kind of see what his thinking was and how he would have defended himself had the trial actually gone forward. And Herman Melville wrote a poem about it, and it's one of the interesting times in American history in 1856.
Who was his lawyer? Did he have a lawyer for?
Yeah, he did actually, and you know, it's funny because the person who gave him legal guidance right after he was indicted was a U.S. senator from Maryland named Reverend E. Johnson. He basically was the one who liaised with Grant about a possible pardon, and Johnson also gave him the advice about what to expect. He also had another lawyer named Francis Smith that handled a lot of the business matters. And I think, you know, as it seemed more likely, Reverend Johnson sort of exit stage left as Lee feels like, you know, they're probably not going to push this thing because the Davis file broke down in 1868. And with that breaking down, that's when Lee was eventually, he didn't receive an individual pardon, but Johnson gave a general amnesty on Christmas Day in 1868 that would apply to all of those Confederate leaders who had been indicted. So basically, Johnson folded his cards and just ended it right there. And then they dropped the indictment in February of 1869, which was 1 month before Johnson left office.
So did Lee ever actually appear in court for any pre-trial
things? Yes, I do. He did, but in an interesting capacity. He was called as a witness for the Jefferson Davis trial. So he had to come down to Richmond from Lexington, Virginia, and he had to appear in court, and they let him in a holding room for, you know how it is if you go down for jury duty or something. Mm-hmm. He was in there for about 5 hours, and then they call him in. And I think he was there, I think he may have been there for 2 days, but it wasn't a lot of testimony, because one of the interesting things about the treason case that they were going to make against all of these guys is that, there was no mystery about whether they made war or not.
Right.
they had been fighting, right? So in some ways, as Lee mentioned when he brought in as a witness, look, they were asking me questions that everybody knew the answer to, So it was sort of like, I think in the Constitution, they require that there be witnesses to the treason, and Lee was one of those ones chosen. And I wonder, you know, Tony, I didn't really explore that so much, but it would have been interesting if it didn't really need to be Lee for that, and you wondered what part of that was symbolic. You know what I mean? To drag him down to testify to stuff that everybody already knew. It could have been any other Confederate officer could have answered those same questions to establish that Davis first, you know, was the president of the Confederacy. So, you know, I didn't really pursue that line of inquiry, but it seems to me that there was a little bit of symbolism and maybe also a little bit of hardball by doing that to Lee.
I wonder how much it was just political theater held in a courtroom, you know, for someone's future.
Yeah, I think it was. I really do. And, you know, Usher was not above that. Like, it was some of his, you know, I think I mentioned that he was the most hated man in Virginia because he would have these really provocative opening statements to the courtroom about traitors and slave owners and, you know, and remember, so one thing just to kind of cover one of the details is Underwood indicted everyone in Norfolk, which was the center of the district court, but the trials would have all appeared in Richmond, which was the center of the circuit court. And, you know, these are details that maybe are not that important, but when Underwood was kind of going on his high horse, then basically insulting the entire Confederacy, that was all happening in Richmond. That's why, you know, the most hated man in Virginia, and you know who made some really snarky comments about Underwood was Lee's wife. Very Lee. It was, in some ways, one of the more feisty Confederates of all, you know, in some of the things she said. But, she really didn't like Underwood.
Interesting. So, where did you find your source material for this book?
Yeah, you know, so I'll start with the kind of the central document, which was kind of funny and interesting how I came across it. But, like I said, I was reading about this period and I was sort of interested in, and, you know, gosh, I didn't really know much about these treason trials. What did that look like and how serious was it, you know? So I thought, like, well, the first step is to get the documents. And then I was reading, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but the kind of number one biography of Lee is by Douglas Sotloff Freeman, four-volume biography, Pulitzer Prize, and Freeman, as a historian, is outstanding. I mean, he's very pro-Lee, and you have to be mindful of that bias, but at the same time, he's an outstanding historian. Anyway, long story short, he says in his book, all of the indictments Lee and the other leaders had disappeared. Right? And so I was like, okay, so that's, we can't find those don't exist. And then I noticed another writer writing way back in 1860s, I think actually 1872 or so, his name is Bradley Johnson, was writing, and he also said all the indictments just disappeared. So I thought, okay, and then this is, remember the part where I told you, like, the part of me that was sort of interested in an investigation kind of kicked into overdrive, and I just started being, you know, just kind of digging into that, still reading and still thinking, hey, there's a story here, but wouldn't it be cool if I could actually find the document? And so one day, you know, fiddling around, and by the way, I should say that all of the contemporary scholars that I looked at, nobody referred to the actual document. Like, people were aware that this happened. Some knew more than others, and there was a lot of misinformation, but nobody specifically pointed to the document itself and as if they had seen it or quoted from it or whatever. So anyway, with that, then we said, by the way, when I say that, that's not to say that there wasn't someone who did, because obviously I didn't do an exhaustive secondary search, but I looked at all the, you know, contemporary authors, and I didn't see anyone who was actually referring to the specific document, legal document. But anyway, long story short, I eventually stumbled across this little tidbit in the late 30s in the New York Times, and the headline was literally, "Box of Indictments Found in Richmond Courtroom." And sure enough, you know, it mentions that 34 of the 37 documents of the Underwood courtroom found, and it was just this little tidbit, this little blurb, but I thought, okay, I know that they have, unlike Freeman, I know that they actually haven't disappeared into the ether, because this Times article appeared after the Freeman book. So I knew that they existed somewhere, and then now it was just a matter of where. So I went up to, I called the National Archives, and they thought that they were probably in their Philadelphia office. I headed up there, I looked in the relevant box, opened it, and there's a little note. Anything that was in this box has been moved to Richmond. So I had to go down to Richmond, and there they were. They were at the State Library of Virginia. 34 of the 37 indictments, plus the Lee indictment, which I have a copy of now. And it was really fascinating to kind of see these old documents and something that, you know, hadn't really been talked about by historians, but they were, you know, they're all written in English from the Middle Ages. So the language is fascinating. You know, it's this very ancient, and I think because the custom for the diapers was to just use this language that had been used for centuries. So, but yeah, anyway, that was sort of a long story. Yeah. About how I found those documents. And then I was able to find a lot of other interesting things that I don't think have been mined that carefully. For example, one set of documents that was invaluable was that people might not know that before Johnson was impeached for violating the Tenure of Office Act, among other things, they wanted to impeach him for not being vigorous enough in prosecuting the Confederates. And they held some hearings around that. Unfortunately, the finding was that Johnson was the most vigorous in wanting to prosecute the Confederates. So the Congress was, okay, we're going to have to impeach him about something else. but those hearings where they were asking about Johnson's attitude towards the Confederate leaders were an invaluable source about the trial and about treason and what have you, because it was an all-star list of testimony. You know, Grant, Selman Chase, Underwood, the Attorney General James Speed, the District Attorney Lucien Chandler. You know what I mean? So they all had to, you know, read the testimony. And I thought that, you know, I haven't found that many other scholars have mined that. So that was another great source that I was able to use for this. So yeah, you know, one thing I found, with one of the reasons why I decided to pursue a book is I found a real rich maze of primary sources that didn't seem to have been used. Mm-hmm. You know, so I kind of felt like, well, this is good stuff to present and include, you know.
Right. So what other locations did he go to find primary sources? Any others apart from what you mentioned?
Oh yeah, so as I said, I went down to Richmond, spent some time there. I'm really lucky. I live in D.C., so I went to the Library of Congress and used that extensively. So a lot of these papers are in the Library of Congress. In fact, you know, one thing that caught my attention, and this might for almost, you know, for people who like investigations and hunts and stuff, there's a box in the Lee papers that they don't have permission to let you look at. So I'm sort of like, I want to look at that.
Yeah.
Look at that box, you know. And you know my best guess about that is, I think it's Mary Lee's wife. I think it's about her, it's papers relating to her, and I think it might be Mary Lee maybe saying uncertain things, but, you know, that's just guessing. I have no idea what's the forbidden box. But anyway, I looked at a lot of papers at Library of Congress relating to Lee. And then, obviously, Andrew Johnson has his papers at the Library of Congress, too. And one of the things that I loved and I included in my book is one of the events I talk a lot in my book about is the assassination of Lincoln. And after the death of Lincoln, Northerners were not only angry, but they were really upset. And there were just numerous letters to Andrew Johnson about, you know, what are going to do about these praetors? And, you know, and there, one of the things that people might be surprised to find is there were a lot of people that were kind of glad, you know, tough as hell Andrew Johnson is in charge, because Lincoln was seen as too kind and too nice. He was gonna let the Confederacy off easy. And Johnson, throughout the war, was, you know, he was well known for going around saying he wanted to make treason odious, and he was gonna really punish these characters. You know what I mean? So a lot of people were writing, you know, we're sad about Lincoln, but well, at least we got a tough guy now in the Oval Office, and he's gonna make them pay. And in any event, yeah, so Library of Congress had all these wonderful letters from just ordinary citizens to Andrew Johnson, so I used a lot of that too. Then I use the National Archives, which is also in D.C. I have to go up to College Park, Maryland for the relevant documents from the archives. And then I went to Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia for a lot of Lee's papers. So yeah, those are the primary locations. I think for this topic, I was quite fortunate to live in Washington, D.C. Because I could, so for example, you know, Judge Underwood's papers are also at the Library of Congress. There's not a lot of them, but I went there. I looked at them three times. And by looking at them often, I was able to kind of unlock a few things that I may not have. You know what I mean? So proximity, I think, sometimes is a mini asset, because I can just jump on the train and go down there. Whereas, you know, if I was doing research, say, in an archive in Rochester, I would go up to Rochester to do what I could in a few days, and then I'm coming back home, and I really don't have the luxury to go back there again, or, you know what I mean, or I could, but it would be difficult, so, yeah.
So, apart from finding the indictments, what part of the research would you say was most enjoyable?
Yeah, oh, great question. You know, I think, well, one of the things that I found was fascinating to me was I write a chapter where I try to be as fair as possible to assess Lee and the institution of slavery. You know, what were his real attitudes, but also what was his real relationship to it? And so that I found interesting because I really dug into the documents, and I think that I at least tried to tell a story that hasn't been told in that much depth. I think that there's others, of course, that have, obviously. But I tried to make it in relation to this criticism of him and, like, hey, is it fair to criticize him on this topic or not? And I found a lot of documents related to his management of his father-in-law's estate. And I don't know how familiar you are with this, but the thing that they, and this has come up recently, the thing that he has been criticized most for was this issue relating to a man named Wesley Norris, who was one of his slaves. And Wesley Norris comes out in 1866 and says, you know, Master Lee had us whipped brutally, me, my sister, and my cousin, and then he had Brian and Salt put on, you know, our backs after the whipping. And it just sounded so cruel. I mean, and so was he really that cruel, or was this just sort of, you know, propaganda that was being put out by northern abolitionist newspapers to kind of make him look bad? And so I actually really dug into that. And you know what? There were countless variations of the charges. And I dug in. And you know, I'll tell you what I found. I think that Wesley Norris's account is probably accurate, as he put it. It's hard to say. I think that Lee, once again, there was also nothing illegal about what he did, because under Virginia law, that sort of thing was allowed. Whether it was particularly brutal, you know, once again, under the standards of the time, I think it probably would have been considered brutal for someone like Lee to have his slaves whipped like that. But in any event, I think that the Wesley Norris account is probably true. I say probably. I think we can't know for sure, obviously. And so, you know, I think that you should always have that caveat. And then Lee himself, denied the story, but didn't deny the details. So it was sort of a hazy denial, like, you know, I've never acted improperly with my slaves. You know, it was that kind of denial. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know what I mean? So, anyway, I thought that was interesting. And then one of the things that I dug in on, too, was, you know, a couple other people have done this as well, but I found that, and I, you know, I got the documents from the Library of Virginia about how he managed his father-in-law's estate. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I discovered is that he petitioned the court to keep the slaves longer than his father-in-law had intended. And so I think that fits this notion that, you know, maybe after the war was, you know, hey, I've always been opposed to slavery, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, here were some documents that show that you actually wanted to keep these 200 slaves longer. It's a very convoluted kind of legal question. And I read the book, I don't think there was anything really untoward about it. I mean, I think he really tried to pursue it through the court system. And you know, you could say that to his credit, like he did it, you know, he tried to do the right thing. When his petition was denied, and then he did free them, and he actually freed them shortly after the Battle of Fredericksburg. So, in some ways, it's sort of impressive that someone with so much on his mind was actually still following through on what was expected from that Virginia court, you know, in January, I think it was January 1863, so yeah, it was sort of after Fredericksburg in 1862. So, you know, in some ways that was the pinnacle of his success, and yet, you know, he had petitioned to keep the slaves longer, he lost, and then he set them free. Obviously, setting them free at that time was problematic on many levels. Some of them had already more or less freed themselves, so to speak, and then there were others that didn't know quite where to go in the Civil War, you know, so, but that was, so to your initial question, I'd say that if I were to zero in on one thing, I think that chapter was some of the research I was, you know, really fascinated by and was really sort of motivated to go further.
So what was the most surprising thing you found in your research, if you haven't mentioned that already?
Yeah. No, you know, I would say that one of the most surprising, I think, well, there's funny, I'll mention two, and they're related. One of the surprising things that, to me, was that when I started this project before this national debate we've been having about the Confederate leaders and monuments, and you know, if you go back to that horrific Charleston church shooting, right, and then in that, the aftermath of that, we started to kind of debate this issue, like, why don't we even honor these Confederate leaders? And then, of course, last summer with the Charlottesville protests and the violence there, and then it popped up again, and then I think recently it popped up when, you know, Chief of Staff Kelly said, you know, these are honorable men. So it's been popping up, right? But when I started this project, then we weren't having this discussion. So one of the kind of the interesting takeaways for me, or the interesting developments, was that this sort of just coincidentally happened as I'm in the midst of this research while I was trying to make the case with, how did someone who was indicted for treason become a national hero? You know,
right.
And I think a lot of us are having that conversation right now. And that's a question that I really do pursue at the end of the book. And once again, to answer your question, it's related to this debate. I think I put forward a hypothesis that basically, you know, not only was did Lee not get prosecuted for treason, But he himself, and then later his acolytes, put forward a vigorous defense of his character, which became sort of part of this lost cause petition, which is more or less the memory that we all have, well, until relatively recently, of the Civil War, which was that, hey, the South was honorable, they fought for states' rights, they lost, but, you know, they probably would have won if they had as many men, but they had fewer resources, and you know, what about slavery? It was about states' rights, and Lee was the greatest hero of all in the war. You know, that's the lost cause tradition. Mm-hmm. And it has been extremely persuasive and widespread in America. And so I talk about that in the end of my book, about how the emergence of that lost cause tradition is what allowed Lee to become this national hero in you know, by the middle of the 21st century. He's admired by Northerners and Southerners, you know, and he, you know, one of the funny things that I talk about in my book, that I live blocks away from the National Cathedral here in Washington, D.C., and there was a stained glass window of Robert E. Lee at the National Cathedral. I mean, what could be more a kind of a national hero than that? That window was taken down last fall in the aftermath of the Charlottesville demonstrations and protests and what have you. So I think, circling back to your original question, I think how this has all sort of come together right as I'm writing this book, it has been really fascinating to me that, you know, it's literally, you know, history is being sort of being made as I'm trying to complete the book. You know?
So what was the most difficult question to answer, either one that you finally did get an answer for, or something that still you feel like it's there, but you haven't reached the reached the conclusion yet?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question, and I would say maybe I put forward some ideas, but maybe the question is like, well, why didn't they successfully prosecute these Confederate leaders? The will was there, right? Meaning the Johnson cabinet and all of the legal officials wanted to do it. I think the people would have supported prosecutions at least in 1865, perhaps 1866, though it gets trickier with each passing year. But they weren't able to do it. And so I do talk about that, obviously. I try to answer that question. But at the same time, you know, it's a complex question, because it's almost a counterfactual, you know what I mean? Like, well, what would have happened had they put them on trial, and would they have won? Or was just delaying it and then dropping it, was that maybe the right move all along, you know? So I think trying to come up with some good, solid conclusions about why they didn't eventually successfully prosecute the Confederate leaders, that was probably one thing that I put out some ideas, but I don't think we have good, solid, the prevailing hypothesis now is that Salmon Case, who was the Chief Justice who would have to preside at the trial, that he was sort of half-hearted about doing this and was going out of his way to kind of delay it and almost undermine it in a way. But, you know, he actually denied that charge. So, you know, you have to be careful of not going too far. But in any event, they eventually had to drop it because just one thing after another. You know, the fact that Johnson got impeached in 1868 obviously didn't help matters either, because that was sort of a lost year for him. You know, he was fighting for the survival of the presidency and was in no position to kind of make this case happen. But yeah, so that would probably be the biggest one of, you know, uncertainty with the book.
Okay. What do you hope this book will do?
Yeah, you know, I hope I would be very grateful and just delighted if people would return to learning more about that period, 1865, 1866, 67. I think, you know, I told you I used to be a history professor and teacher, and, you know, I think the historical profession and a lot of the books and a lot of the public are very focused on the Civil War itself. And the aftermath of the war often doesn't get as much treatment or as much interest. And yet, I think the aftermath is extremely important, right? And so, you know, when you look at that period, 1865 to 1870, you see the seeds for why Reconstruction ultimately failed, and you see, you know, you see how perhaps, you know, some of this, the Jim Crow era emerged a couple decades later, And so anyway, I think it's at the pivotal period. And so I'm glad that I wrote about it because it's often not written about. Mm-hmm. And then I hope that maybe readers will kind of say, hey, instead of another book on Gettysburg, which is a great topic, and I'm someone who wants to read another book on Gettysburg, but maybe a biography of Thaddeus Stevens, or maybe, looking at, Du Bois's book on Reconstruction, or, let's rediscover that period during Andrew Johnson's presidency and into Grant's presidency.
Yeah, get a full picture of everything that was going on, apart from the battlefield fighting.
Yeah, and I think Chego made that case in his book on Grant, which I thought, number one, I loved his book, it was so good. Mm. But also, I thought that was a great point he made, that, hey, this part of his life is not well studied after the war, because most people, I would plead guilty to this myself, when we study Grant, we study the warriors, and we often don't look at his experience during Reconstruction and during his presidencies.
Mm-hmm. So, did you have any difficulties in getting the book published? And if so, how did you overcome them?
Yeah, great question. So, I would say yes and no. I originally approached a few top publishers, and I was lucky to get my proposal in front of a few people, and but I wasn't succeeding right away, and then I decided to just write it. I wrote the whole book. At first, I had a proposal in a couple of chapters, and I was pitching that to a few really good publishers, and then I just wrote the whole book. And then I went back at it to some independent publishers with a completed manuscript. Mm. And that's when I got an offer from Roman and Littlefield, which I was delighted, and they've been great. And so it's all worked out. But for me, I think, with just the proposal and a couple of chapters, I was getting some nibbles, but nobody was kind of committing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just thought, well, I've got this book in me. I'm just going to go write it,
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll go back out again. And so that's how it worked out.
Okay. What's your next writing project, if there is one?
Yeah, there is one, in fact. I'm well into it at the moment. And I'm writing about the Battle of the Wilderness.
Hmm. Okay.
I think it's a book I'm really excited about. But this one is much more of a story. And basically, it's about a private who joined up as a substitute at the Battle of the Wilderness, and he participates in the Battle of the Wilderness. He goes into the woods within minutes of the battle, and he gets shot in the jaw.
Hmm.
And then he's transported first to Fredericksburg, and then up to D.C. in a D.C. hospital. They do surgery, and he dies. And then they eventually bury him as one of the first. One of the very first soldiers to be buried in our international cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways it's that journey of that individual in, going to the battle and then participating in the battle and then going up to the hospital and then dying, and then, that ceremony of honoring him, so that's the main thread. And then around that is the battle itself with, the various participants and the strategy and some of the things that happened. It was a horrific battle, but it was also the first time that Lee and Grant square off against one another. And it was also the opening of the Overland campaign, which was obviously one of the most sort of horrific, 5 or 6 weeks in American history. So anyway, there's just a lot to it. I'm really excited to get going. I got about 2 chapters written already.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I had that was, for me, just a real great opportunity. Long story short, I bumped into some officers from West Point at my local coffee shop, and they do something called a staff ride, which is they visit battlefields and they learn about battles, and they go to all the various locations. Mm-hmm. And they were doing a staff, a bunch of former, Army and Navy officers were going to the wilderness, and they invited me to join them. So I went down with them, and it was just best. I learned so much, And I'm going to hopefully incorporate a lot into the book from that,
So is this going to be a fiction or nonfiction book?
It's nonfiction, yeah. Oh, I should be clear, it's nonfiction. But what I mean is, even though it's nonfiction, I try to have, the element of storytelling in it, as opposed to being sort of a flat-out sort of history. And there's been some fantastic, straight-up academic histories of the wilderness. Gordon Ray, for example, is one that, if you've ever read it, it's fantastic. So, but my book isn't quite that. It's more just looking at, several individuals and what their experience was. And as I said, in some ways, the book is at a large level is about the suffering of this private soldier and his contribution to the war effort. Yeah.
So, do you have a webpage or anything for your work? Where can people find your stuff?
Yeah, so I do. I have, I'm on Twitter, which I use a lot. So you can find me there at ReevesJW. And then I also have a website. And, I can get you the, web address in just one second.
Sure. And you said, the Twitter handle is what, again?
Oh, yeah. So it's at Reeves, R-E-E-V-E-S, J-W.
Okay.
And then my website is john-reeves.com.
Okay. All right. That's all the questions I have. Do you have any final words or thoughts?
No, well, thank you so much for the interview. I really enjoyed it, and, I hope people enjoy the book.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Well, thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please like or follow me on Facebook under warscholar.org, on Twitter under warscholar, on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945. More information can be found at warscholar.org. Thank you.